From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Teaching subservience to power, Columbia University imposes and then lifts a gag order on Al Gore's journalism students. Also, In Between the Lines, how the New York Times frames youth. And then it's President Clinton, once again, on the record. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli Prime Minister-elect Ariel Sharon and his predecessor Ehud Barak talked today about setting up a joint government, even though the two disagree sharply on how to make peace with the Palestinians. Sharon offered Barak the position of defense minister, according to a Sharon aide. Before the meeting, Barak backed up a key Sharon claim, saying Sharon is not obligated to stand by concessions that Barak offered the Palestinians. Sharon said in an interview published today that he would seek an open-ended, non-belligerency pact with the Palestinians, not a peace agreement, and that he would not follow Barak's path. Sharon also insisted he will not launch peace talks until all violence in the West Bank and Gaza Strip has ceased. Meanwhile, a UN human rights team starts a week-long mission to the Israeli-occupied Arab territories tomorrow to investigate violations during protests in which nearly 400 people, mostly Palestinian, have been killed. The panel will report to the annual UN Commission on Human Rights, which opens its annual session in Geneva in March. The 53-member state forum held a special session last October, which condemned Israel for, quote, war crimes and crimes against humanity in the territories, and launched the probe. And finally, an Arab American group is denouncing Israel's newly elected hardline prime minister as a war criminal. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee declared that Ariel Sharon was involved in at least four massacres of hundreds of unarmed civilians in the West Bank and in Lebanon when he was a general in the Israeli army. A group spokesman says if Sharon were a Serb, he'd be hauled in front of a war crimes tribunal. The group has about 20,000 members in the United States. Colombian President Andres Pastrana traveled to rebel territory yesterday, where he was embraced by guerrilla chief Manuel Morlanda and held very productive talks, they said. In their third face-to-face encounter, Pastrana is trying to get Morlanda's Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, to return to formal peace talks that they called off in November. FARC is demanding that Pastrana crack down on a right-wing paramilitary and paramilitary groups that have been massacring suspected rebel sympathizers and to scale back a so-called anti-drug offensive backed by $1.3 billion in U.S. military aid. A possible prisoner exchange is also on the table. Meanwhile, authorities have arrested a police officer in the shooting of a labor leader who was pushing for peace talks between the Colombian government and guerrillas. Wilson Borja, president of the Federation of State Workers, was shot twice and grazed in the head last December when right-wing paramilitary gunmen opened fire on his vehicle. During the shootout in Bogota, a sidewalk coffee vendor and a gunman were killed. Some 60 labor leaders were slain last year in Colombia, according to the labor ministry. Many of them are thought to be victims of right-wing paramilitary forces. Rwanda's president opened talks with the Belgian government today as part of renewed efforts to end fighting in Congo, where Rwandan troops are backing anti-government rebels. President Paul Kagame's visit comes less than a week after the new Congolese president, Joseph Kabila, made a similar visit to Belgium, the former colonial ruler of both Congo and Rwanda, which is seeking to advance peace talks. The Belgian foreign minister took a lead in trying to revive peace when he became the only Western minister to attend Laurent Kabila's funeral. He then embarked on a tour of African nations involved in the conflict. Here in this country, congressional investigators say more women than men have been hurt by dangerous drugs pulled from pharmacy shelves in recent years. A rash of drug bans has drawn criticism that the Food and Drug Administration has approved new medicines too quickly, only to be forced to withdraw them later. Among the pulled drugs that are two once wildly popular weight loss medications, Redux and Pondamin. In some cases, rare side effects never seen in early testing caused deaths once the drugs were widely used. And this news on press censorship. Russian prosecutors launched a fresh raid today on companies owned by businessman Vladimir Gusinsky, a day after the U.S. accused the Russian authorities of interfering in media freedoms. Gusinsky says he's fighting Kremlin attempts to stamp out the independence of his media companies, including the TV station NTV, Russia's only national broadcaster outside the influence of the Kremlin. A spokesperson for Gusinsky's Media Mos holding company said around 20 officials from the office of the prosecutor general had carried out the raid, about the 30th since prosecutors began investigating. And finally, Iranian police used tear gas today to disperse about 300 protesters gathered in northern Tehran Park to demand freedom of expression. Witnesses said police and members of hardline paramilitary volunteer forces made dozens of arrests. Scores of protesters were seen being thrown from minibuses. Others fled the park. The Islamic Republic news agency said the mostly young protesters were demanding freedom of expression, and the witnesses reported some of them were chanting, "Long live freedom."
Consider the impasse of a one-God universe. He is all-knowing and all-powerful. He can't go anywhere since he is already everywhere. He can't do anything since the act of doing presupposes opposition. His universe is irrevocably thermodynamic, having no friction by definition. So he has to create friction. War, fear, sickness, death. Keep his dying show on the road.
And that's William S. Burroughs, One God Universe, here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On Tuesday, when the former Vice President, Al Gore, gave his first lecture as a part-time journalism teacher at Columbia University, his students were under a gag order. They were told the class taught by Gore and presidential candidate was off the record. Yesterday, under pressure, Columbia lifted the gag order after widespread criticism that the policy violated not only academic freedom, but also journalistic ethics. Some wags noted, however, that Columbia's catering to Gore would give fledgling reporters a great lesson in how to cultivate powerful sources by caving in to ethically problematic ground rules. While some students did talk to reporters in general terms after Gore's first lecture, no one in the class openly rejected the policy. According to a leaked memo, which is apparently authentic, students had to agree to the gag order as a precondition for attendance. It said, "We expect that you will comply with the decision to offer the seminar on an off-the-record basis. Your attendance will be taken as evidence that, in accordance with the school's honor system, you accept this stipulation." Columbia University Journalism School Administration did not return calls. The Columbia incident raises serious issues about journalistic ethics and the relationship between reporters and the people they cover. We're joined right now by two people to talk about what has happened and what the ground rules were until tremendous pressure and attention came to the gag order. David McCauley is with us. He's a Kenyan journalist who is studying at Columbia. He's a fellow at the Columbia Journalism School. He was not in Al Gore's class. And we're also joined on the telephone by Professor Steve Weinberg, who is a freelance investigative reporter and former executive director of the Investigative Reporters and Editors at Missouri School of Journalism. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with David McCauley. Can you tell us how this all came about, Al Gore's class at Columbia?
Thank you very much, Amy. Al Gore's class was introduced. It's actually part of the regular curriculum, the course that he's invited to give as a guest teacher. National Affairs Reporting has been there.
If you can speak as loud as you can, David McCauley.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm saying that Al Gore's class has not been introduced as such. Basically, for Al Gore, the class has been there, the National Affairs Reporting. And this semester, Al Gore was brought in to be an adjunct professor in that particular course. But there are two regular professors who give that course. However, I think an agreement had been struck between I'll go and the school, that the kind of things that I'll go is going to talk about in class will not be taken out of class as if somebody had interviewed Algo. I think the order was basically to tell students that, you know, you cannot use the information that is coming out of this class to probably write a story and attribute it to him as if it was credible information. The assumption was that the vice president would probably be at ease talking about some things that he wouldn't talk about openly as if he was addressing a press conference. That is the situation.
Professor Steve Weinberg at University of Missouri School of Journalism, where, by the way, Democracy Now! Is broadcast on KOPN. What was your response to hearing the deal that Al Gore made with the School of Journalism?
Of course, I was amazed that anybody in a journalism school would agree to a deal like that, and especially amazed because I know the dean of the Columbia University Journalism School, Tom Goldstein, and I've always respected him immensely. Of course, I don't know precisely what role he played in this agreement, but surely he must have been involved. He's a former New York Times reporter, a former Wall Street Journal reporter, just a fine journalist, and so it surprised me all the more.
Well, I was talking to a journalist friend in the corporate media yesterday who said she didn't see such a problem with making an agreement like this. I mean, the school should be free to have classes where people don't go reporting out what's said. And what if he wants to say something personal and doesn't want the whole news media to know about it?
Well, of course the school should be free to do that. I mean, it's not a state university. There's a lot of private money involved there. The question isn't should. I mean, I don't think Columbia University broke any laws, but why would you do that? First of all, if you've ever heard politicians speak shortly after leaving office, and I've heard many of them, they almost never, in fact, I can't think of one instance where they ever say anything that is so sensitive it shouldn't go out to the public. But even if he said something sensitive, that's all the more reason not to have a policy like that, because, you know, here is somebody who's been living at the public trough for a long time and to some extent is going to continue living at the public trough. Why should he have some kind of special privilege to speak his mind in private, especially in a university setting where the tradition has always been open inquiry?
That's Steven Weinberg, professor at Missouri School of Journalism. David McCauley, what differences in pressure on the press in your native Kenya and here?
I think to back home, Kenya, I mean, we look at America's kind of model of freedom of expression with all the protections of the First Amendment and so on. And I must admit that it kind of upset me initially when I got to see the off-the-record restriction, and we straight away, you know, began raising questions about that. And I think the school discovered that there must have been something rather, you know, out of the ordinary in that order. So the school kind of, you know, stepped back, but it leaves me with some kind of, you know, I think bad notions about the fact that this kind of thing. I mean, we used to see this kind of stuff in our countries where we have some kind of intolerance from politicians and a lot of secrecy around information. But that kind of upset me to get here and to find that such practice also can exist in this country. But I think the more serious intrusion, in my view, is the fact that Al Gore as a politician should still be given the opportunity to step into the School of Journalism in the capacity of an instructor and talking to prospective journalists and current journalists. Because, I mean, some of us are
as loud as you can, David McCauley. Very bad line.
And I think the whole notion that a politician, whatever his stature, whatever his knowledge, should be allowed to teach in a School of Journalism, you know, kind of offends the basic principle of separating the institution of the press from any encroachment by the politician. And that's really where the issue lies. I think the issue of off the record seems to me to have been made in good faith by the school, to focus the attention on what on the content of Algoa's address. But to me, I think the larger issue is that a politician should be allowed to come and teach journalists. Whatever the relationship, I think the relationship between a journalist practicing or training ought to be very clear out there. The interaction should be very clear, and there should be no kind of arrangements which compromise the integrity of the profession or the independence of the journalist in looking at the politician.
Steve Weinberg, you have a policy of not using unnamed sources. Can you explain that?
Well, it's something that's born from experience. I learned both as a reporter in Washington, D.C. and in other parts of the country that the people who are hurt by the use of unnamed sources are the audience members who we're trying to serve. They rarely, if ever, have a way to evaluate the motives of the unnamed sources, the level of knowledge of the unnamed sources. So I just stopped using them. I felt that I was a good enough reporter to dig out the information from documents or name sources, and that if I wasn't good enough, then I just wouldn't touch on that particular topic that I was unable to document. It's as simple as that.
Columbia's lifting of the gag order came just after two small Tennessee universities at which Al Gore will be teaching about community and family, not journalism, touted the fact that their lectures would be on the record. I think that's pretty interesting. And then Columbia shifts. We did put a call into the dean of the Columbia School of Journalism, but he didn't want to go on, though after that call, they did change the policy and they've lifted the gag order. The kind of socialization that goes on of journalists is very interesting. These are young journalists in training who learn very early that you deal differently with people in power. What do you think of that, David McCauley?
I think that canon, that you know, that policy or principle of journalism need not be violated by anybody. And I think that a school like Columbia ought to be on the front line in defending that standing of journalists as people who are not amenable to the influences of politicians, powerful politicians as that. And the best way to guarantee that is to ensure that they don't get journalists into interaction with politicians or any other powerful influence behind closed doors. And they should leave it open as much as you know it ought to be.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being with us. David McCauley, a Kenyan journalist who is a fellow at the Columbia School of Journalism, not in Al Gore's class, but wrote about his criticism of the class that Al Gore taught, having a gag order imposed on it. So much pressure was brought to bear. Columbia has just lifted that gag order. Also, Professor Steve Weinberg, a freelance investigative reporter and former head of the Investigative Reporters and Editors, an organization that deals with investigative reporting. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, journalists who don't play by Washington's rules rarely get politicians to go on the record or even gain access to the politicians and other powerful people they try to cover. At press conferences, their raised hands are ignored, phone numbers, phone calls not returned. But sometimes politicians who talk only under managed conditions and grant interviews only to the journalists they know are caught in the headlights of a free press. We have one such instance in which President Clinton went on the record and answered questions on substantive issues when all he intended to do was make a packaged get-out-the-vote statement. It did happen last November on Election Day, and this was an interview that we were able to do with him here at WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York when President Clinton called in to tell people to get out the vote. And I did the interview with him with my colleague here at WBAI, Gonzalo Aburto. Mr. President, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
You're calling radio stations to tell people to get out and vote. What do you say to people who feel that the two parties are bought by corporations and that they are, at this point, feel that their vote doesn't make a difference?
That there's not a shred of evidence to support that. That's what I would say. It's true that both parties have wealthy supporters, but let me just give you the differences. Let's look at economic policy. First of all, if you look at the last 8 years, look where America was 8 years ago and look where it is today. We have the strongest economy in history, and for the first time in 30 years, the incomes of average people and lower-income working people have gone up 15% after inflation, the lowest minority unemployment ever recorded, the highest minority home ownership, the highest minority business ownership in history. That's our record. If you look at our proposals, what do we propose to do? We propose a tax cut that helps average people for child care, for long-term care, for paying for college tuition, for retirement savings. We propose to invest large amounts of money in education, health care, the environment, in our future. And we propose to keep paying down the debt because that keeps interest rates lower. What do the Republicans propose? A tax cut that's three times as big. Most of it goes to very wealthy people. The top 1% of the people get as much money as they would spend on health care, education, and the environment combined. They propose to privatize Social Security, and if you add the two things together, we'll be back in deficits, which means the economy will go downhill and interest rates will be higher for ordinary people.
President Clinton.
That's just one example. You asked the question. There's not.
Right.
Look at campaign finance reform. The Democrats are for it. The Republican leadership kills it.
Well, let me just
look at the environment. We got the cleanest environment in history, the best environmental record in history. The Republicans want to reverse our environmental record. So give me. You can't give one example of where both parties are dominated by large corporations, and therefore there's no difference. The American people's lives are a lot better than they were 8 years ago. The truth is, there's an ideological struggle between those who believe that the best way to grow the economy is to give more money to the wealthy, and the Democrats who believe that the wealthy will make more money if average people do better.
President Clinton, since it's rare to get you on the phone, let me ask you another question. And that is, what is your position on granting Leonard Peltier, the Native American activist, executive clemency?
Well, I don't have a position I can announce yet. I believe there is a new application for him in there, and when I have time after the election's over, I'm going to review all the remaining executive clemency applications and, see what the merits dictate. I will try to do what I think the right thing to do is based on the evidence, and I've never had the time actually to sit down myself and review that case. I know it's very important to a lot of people, maybe on both sides of the issue, and I think I owe it to them to give it an honest look-see. So part of my responsibilities in the last 10 weeks of office after the election will be to review the requests for pardons and executive clemencies and give them a fair hearing, and I pledge to do that.
And you will give an answer in his case?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll decide one way or the other.
And finally, do you support a moratorium on the death penalty, given the studies that show how racist it has been,
I think in the case
manner.
Of, I certainly support what the governor of Illinois did, because there was clear evidence in Illinois that a lot of mistakes had been made. In the case of the federal government, I have asked the attorney general to conduct a comprehensive review and to let me and to report back to us on the racial disparities and on any question of guilt, on adequate assistance of counsel, on all those things to determine whether there should be a moratorium. And I haven't gotten her findings yet. Now, so far, the only two cases which have come up have been deferred. while we do this study, and so when that comes in, and if it comes in while I'm still in office, then I'll make a judgment, and if it doesn't, I think that the next president, I would hope, would make the same decision based on the merits, based on what the evidence shows. The disturbing thing to me is that there's not only an apparent racial disparity on death row, but also in the federal government, but also way over half the cases come from a relatively small number of the U.S. attorney's offices, which is, you know, it's disturbing. But again, let me just say this. If you're concerned about that, that's a good reason to vote for Al Gore and Joe Lieberman and Hillary for the Senate, and for the people in New Jersey who can hear you for John Corzine, because we know the Democrats care about these issues, and we know they're not very important to the Republicans. And
Vice
so
President
that's another
Gore,
example of another reason you ought to vote for the Democrats.
Gore supports the death penalty.
He does, but...
And Lieberman.
Yes, they do. But there's a difference in supporting it and thinking that you would carry it out even if you thought the system was fundamentally unfair. His opponent...
But the studies show that it is.
But the studies are not complete, because the studies have to... What the Attorney General is doing is not just looking at everybody that's been convicted, but everybody that could have been charged that wasn't. There's a lot more stuff that needs to be done, and it may confirm the initial view of who's on the death row. But I think what you ought to look at that as compared with Texas, for example, where there was evidence that lawyers falling asleep in their trials were not enough to deter Texas from continuing to carry out the death penalty, which I thought was unacceptable. And so I think that if you're interested in having somebody that at least has the capacity to look at the fairness of this, you only have one choice.
Well, I guess many people were quite disturbed that when you first ran for president, you went back in the midst of your campaign to Arkansas and presided over the execution of a mentally impaired man.
Yeah, but let's go back to the facts here. He was not mentally impaired when he committed the crime. He became mentally impaired because he was wounded after he murdered somebody. And the law says that it's your mental state at the time you committed the crime. That's something no one ever says that when they talk about it. Had he been mentally impaired when he committed the crime, I would never have carried out the death penalty, because he was not in a position to know what he was doing. That is not what the facts were. Secondly, if I had not gone home, I would have been accused of putting a tough decision off on somebody else.
President Clinton, my name is Gonzalo Aburto. I'm a Latino living here in New York. I'm the host of La Nueva Alternativa. Here at BAI, I want to ask you why Latinas and Latinos in the United States should vote for Gore and Lieberman.
The Latinos should know that the Democrats favor fairness for immigrants. Secondly, we favor affirmative action. Thirdly, we favor hate crimes legislation and employment non-discrimination legislation, and the appointments of judges to the Supreme Court that will protect civil rights and human rights. And fourthly, let me say again, we have had an economic policy that has dramatically improved the lives of Latinos. When I became president, the Latino unemployment rate was 11.8%. Today, it is 5%, the lowest in the history of the country. So if you're looking for somebody that wants to make sure everybody is part of America's present and future, Al Gore's your man.
Yet despite massive protests in Puerto Rico, the U.S. Navy continues to bomb, and you've the island of Vieques, and you've authorized this.
Well, now, wait a minute. Wait just a minute now. The United States Navy has an agreement with the government of Puerto Rico, the representative of all the people of Puerto Rico, to turn back the western half of Vieques to Puerto Rico, to not have any live firebombing. There's no live firebombing going on there. And to terminate all the training within a couple of years, during which time they have to find a new place to train. So this training that's going on now is subsequent to an agreement. Now, the Republicans in Congress broke the agreement, and instead of giving the western part of the island to Puerto Rico, gave it to the Interior Department to manage. If I can't find a way to give that island, that western part of the island, back to the people of Puerto Rico, and to honor the agreement that the government of Puerto Rico itself made with the support of the local leaders, including the mayor of Vieques, then the people of Puerto Rico, I think, have a right to say the federal government broke its word and the training has to stop right now. But I think the training should stop because the people don't want it there. we need a place to train, and we're in the process of finding another place, and we made an agreement, and I think the agreement ought to be honored, and I was disappointed that the Congress didn't fully honor it, but I think I can find a way to keep the commitment of the federal government anyway, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Mr. President, what do you think about that possible amnesty for trabajadores indocumentados?
Well, I think that that's what I meant earlier. I've got a bill before Congress now that would treat legal immigrants from Honduras, from Guatemala, from Haiti, from Salvador, in the same way that the Congress has already voted to treat immigrants from Cuba and Nicaragua. I think that it's not right the way we have treated a lot of these immigrant populations differently.
President Clinton, UN figures show that up to 5,000 children a month die in Iraq because of the sanctions against
Iraq. That's not
Iraq.
True. That's not true. And that's not what they show. Let me just tell you something. Before the sanctions, the year before the Gulf War, you said this. How much money did Iraq earn from oil? Answer, $16 billion. How much money did Iraq earn last year from oil? How much money did they get? Cash on the barrel held to Saddam Hussein. Answer, $19 billion that he can use exclusively for food, for medicine, to develop his country. He's got more money now, $3 billion a year more than he had 9 years ago. If any child is without food or medicine or a roof over his or her head in Iraq, it's because he is claiming the sanctions are doing it and sticking it to his own children. We have worked like crazy to make sure that the embargo only applies to his ability to reconstitute his weapon system and his military state. This is a guy who butchered the children of his own country, who were Kurds, who were Shiites. He used chemical weapons on his own people. And he is now lying to the world and claiming the mean old United States is killing his children. He has more money today than he did before the embargo. And if they're hungry or they're not getting medicine, it's his own fault.
The past two UN heads of the program in Iraq have quit, calling the U.S. Policy, U.S.-UN policy, genocidal. What is your response to that?
They're wrong. They think that we should reward Saddam Hussein says, I'm going to starve my kids unless you let me buy nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, and biological weapons. If you let me do everything I want to do so I can get in a position to kill and intimidate people again, then I'll stop starving my kids. And so we're supposed to assume responsibility for his misconduct. That's just not right. I know that, you know, the truth is a lot of these people want to start doing business with Saddam Hussein again because they want his money. And, they want the money he earns from oil.
Mr. President, are we going to see a substantial change in the policy through Cuba, regarding Cuba?
Well, let me say we were on the way to that change. Back in 1996, we had a lot of changes in my first term in our policy toward Cuba, and we were working our way toward a reconciliation, and the Cubans were working their way toward more openness, more freedom for their farmers and their people. We were really making headway, and then they illegally shot down those two planes, and four people died on the planes, and the Congress passed the Cuba, the Helms-Burton bill, so-called, and I don't have much flexibility to do much more. What I have done with Cuba is to use the maximum extent of my legal powers to promote people-to-people contacts with Cuba and the Cuban people. I do believe there that the Cuban people have suffered because of the embargo, and we should do more in the area of food, in the area of medicine, in the area of people-to-people contacts. I believe that it's just a question of time till the United States and Cuba are reconciled, and I think that the situation is tragic.
How do you just...
But it wouldn't have happened if Castro hadn't shot those planes down out of the air in blatant violation of international law. It was just murder. There's no way to put a fine point on it. I mean, and we were... I think he doesn't want the embargo lifted because it's an excuse for the problems that he has with his own administration.
How do you justify imposing the embargo against Cuba and lifting it against China, normalizing relations with China?
Well, first of all, China hasn't killed any of our pilots lately. They haven't murdered any Americans. As a matter of fact, the United States accidentally and tragically killed some Chinese citizens during our military campaign in Kosovo. And we have differences with China that we think can best be resolved. China's a nuclear power. We think they have missile capacity. We've worked very hard with them to reduce the threats of sales of missiles to renegade states, to make the world a safer place. And they've worked with us on peace on the Korean Peninsula to help the North Korean situation. And we would, as I said, I believe if Castro hadn't shot those planes down and the Congress hadn't passed a law which prohibits me from doing anything with the embargo, that we might have made some real progress there.
Amnesty International has described what the Israeli forces are now doing in the occupied territories as...
Listen, I can't do a whole press conference here. It's election day, and I've got a lot of people and places to call.
Well, I guess these are the questions that are very important to our listeners, and these are the questions...
Well, I've answered them all.
Right, and we appreciate that. And
I have answered them all. Now, let me just tell you, on the Israeli-Palestinian thing, the Secretary General of the United Nations and I were together in Egypt. We agreed on a three-pronged strategy to end the violence and restore the peace talks. And with regard to the Amnesty International findings, what we agreed to do was to set up a fact-finding commission to look into what happened, how the recent violence started, and what can be done to avoid it recurring. And the agreement was that that would happen as soon as the violence was stopped. And we've had some progress the last two or three days. Everybody's working hard. And I think the less I say right now, the better publicly, because I don't want to complicate things. I'm working my heart out to stop the violence, get the commission appointed, and get the peace process started. In the Middle East, which is something I know more than a little bit about, the only answer to this over the long run is an agreement that covers all the issues that the Palestinians feel aggrieved by, guarantees the Israelis security and acceptance within the region, and is a just and lasting peace. I think the United Nations will support, I know they will, the implementation of the agreement we made at Sharm el-Sheikh.
Why not support a UN force in the Middle East for the illegal occupation of the territories? And at this point, I think we're around 150 people being killed in the occupied territories, overwhelmingly Palestinian.
You can support it if you want to, but the Israelis won't support it. And there was a war in which that happened. And if you want to make peace, then you have to do things that both sides can agree with. That's what a peace agreement is. And I do not believe that, just as I don't think Israel can forever impose their situation in the Middle East, and they don't either, which is why we started the Oslo peace process 7 years ago, neither do I think that, you know, everybody else saying the UN is going to impose their will on Israel on its own territory will work out either.
Many people say that Ralph Nader is at the high percentage point he is in the polls because you've been responsible for taking the Democratic Party to the right. What do you say to listeners who are listening around the area right now?
Well, I'm glad you asked that.
Concerns?
I'm glad you asked that. This is the last question I've got time for. I'll be happy to answer that. What is the measure of taking the Democratic Party to the right? That we cut the welfare rolls in half? That poverty is at a 20-year low, that child poverty has been cut by a third in our administration, that the incomes of average Americans have gone up 15% after inflation, that poverty among seniors has gone below 10% for the first time in American history, that we have the lowest African-American, the lowest Latino unemployment rate in the history of the country, that we have a 500% increase in the number of minority kids taking advanced placement tests, that the schools in this country, that the test scores among, since we've required all the schools to have basic standards, test scores among African Americans and other minorities have gone up steadily.
Can I say what
now,
some people...
Let me just finish. Now, wait a minute. You started this, and every question you've asked has been hostile and combative. So you listen to my answer. Will you do that?
They've been critical.
Now, you just listen to me. You ask the questions, and I'm going to answer. You have asked questions in a hostile, combative, and even disrespectful tone, and you have never been able to combat the facts I have given you. Now, you listen to this. The other thing Ralph Nader says is that, you know, he's pure as a Caesar's wife on the environment. Under this administration, 43 million more Americans are breathing cleaner air. We have safer drinking water, safer food, cleaner water. We have more land set aside than any administration in history since Theodore Roosevelt. We have cleaned up three times as many toxic waste sites as the previous administrations did in 12 years, and we passed a chemical right to know law that's a very tough law. It's the best environmental record in history. Al Gore's opponent, and one of the two of them are going to be president, Al Gore's opponent has promised to weaken the clean air standards and repeal a lot of the land protections. Now, those are the facts. People can say whatever they want to. Those are the facts.
What people say is that you push through NAFTA, that we have the highest population of prisoners in the industrialized world at over 2 million, that more people are in death row in this country than anywhere else, and that people are
well, all right,
the death
now,
penalty
okay,
imposed on
that's
them.
That's fine, but two-thirds of the American people support that. I think there are too many people in prison, too. I have called for a total evaluation of the people in the federal prison system, a review of the federal sentencing guidelines. I did my best to persuade Congress to get rid of the discrepancy between crack and powdered cocaine in the sentencing guidelines. I agree with that. Nobody ever said America was perfect. I disagree. I think NAFTA has been good for America. I think it's been good. It has helped to reduce illegal immigration. It's helped to provide a decent standard of life in Mexico. I think it has been good. I think the agreement we made to open our markets to Africa and the poor countries in the Caribbean were good for America. People complain about our trade agreements. Trade has accounted for 30% of our economic growth, and we have the lowest unemployment rate in 30 years. How can anybody make a serious case that trade's been bad for America? We have a 15% increase in average income of ordinary Americans, the lowest unemployment rate in 30 years, and the lowest unemployment rate ever recorded among African Americans and Hispanics. Now, I don't think you can make a sane case that if we closed up our markets, that either Africa or Latin America or America would be better off.
President Clinton, on the record, on Election Day, I interviewed him with Gonzalo Oberto of WBAI. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Despite a 33% drop in juvenile crime since 1993, the majority of Americans believe that juvenile crime is on the rise. Youth face zero tolerance policies in courtrooms, classrooms, neighborhoods, and prisons. Almost all the states have enacted laws making it easier to transfer youth from the juvenile justice system to the criminal justice system. School boards have brought police departments into the schools, and in the streets, youth, especially youth of color, meet with fear from civilians and harassment and violence from police. According to a recent ABC poll, 82% of the people who perceive crime as a national problem say their assessment is based on what they see in the news. Young people who are the target of stereotypes are well aware of the connection between prejudice and the influence of the media. So a national media training group called We Interrupt This Message joined forces with Youth Force, a youth-led South Bronx organizing group, to study how youth crime gets reported. 2 weeks ago, after a year's work, the groups published their final report, In Between the Lines, How the New York Times Frames Youth. We're joined now by members of both groups. Pia Infante is with We Interrupt This Message, and Quesha Alakin and Joseph Vasquez are with Youth Force. Joseph, tell us how you did this report.
Well, basically, we did a study on three month period from January 2000 to March 2000. We clipped 93 articles, and we basically did a study on how the New York Times portrays youth and crime.
And Keisha Alakin, what did you find?
Well, we found that there was a myth of rising school violence, meaning that they were reporting more violence in schools than what were really true. We found a lot of unexamined solutions. mostly the solution they found to youth in crime were to place them in adult jails. There were invisible causes and trends. There were one-sided stories, differential coverage based on race, things such like as that.
Mm-hmm. Pia Infante, you're with We Interrupt This Message, sort of the coordinator of this project.
Mm-hmm.
What was the inspiration for it?
The inspiration is that actually these young people are very well aware of the negative portrayal of young people of color, especially in the media. What we wanted to look at was whether or not coverage of the Times was actually providing an accurate picture of what was going on in youth and crime, because as you probably know, youth crime has actually declined 33% since 1993. So one of the things we're looking at is, because the Times had such an impact on public perception, what was the coverage of youth and crime for the particular period that we looked at, and what does it mean to us and to readers?
Can you give me some examples of how a story was covered?
Well, in two articles we found of, like, they showed, like, a Latino in, like, a picture. They showed him in shackles and in a courtroom. And then they also show in the article, it states his criminal background, his criminal record. And with Caucasian youth, they show his high school picture, and they mention about his goals in life and talents in life.
Meaning we found a difference between the way youth of color were portrayed and white youth who were accused of crimes were portrayed. That was one of our findings.
Joseph Vasquez, is this something that you found repeated over and over again, that kind of difference, sort of with a white kid, it's a story of a tragedy. You know, you might have a good kid somehow gone bad, but then when you have a Latino kid or a black kid, this is a story of a bad kid, and it's accentuated, like you said, by the picture of him in shackles, and that scares people. Is this repeated over and over in the stories? Do you have another example of a story like this?
It is a repeated thing, but like process, like, because, like, that's another one of our findings, differential coverage based on race. But, like, we didn't, like, just base it on race. Like, we just looked at the whole, you know, all the youth, how they all portrayed in Youth of Crime. Like in the myth of rising school violence, how every time, like, something happens in a school, they always mention Columbine. And they always had to put that in there.
So what does that coverage do you think? I mean, what does it do to your own self-image?
Well, we are directly negatively impacted by unbalanced coverage of youth crime in the New York Times and other media, because, like, policymakers, they read, like, policymakers and citizens of the nation, of, you know, they read these papers, and it says, we also found that people know more about the crime from hearing the news and reading the paper than they do of their own experience. So, like, when these policymakers are reading in the paper that, you know, youth crime is occurring, they're going to put more money into building prisons and less money into schools. As my school, Satellite Academy, we have no textbooks. The teachers have to buy their own textbooks, and then they have to make copies of pages so we could, you know, learn on that, you know? And, like, because, like, we don't really have that much money.
Question: how does it affect how you view yourself and other young people like you?
Well, excuse me. Being a person of color in America, you're already born with a stereotype. Doesn't help. The coverage of youth and crime doesn't help, because there have been times when I've been out with my friends and we could be coming from the bowling alley and a cop will ride past and slow down and beep the lights or beep the horn. You know, I've been pulled over and stopped and searched by male cops. It's just, it makes it really difficult to live as a teenager in America.
Have you all been stopped by police?
Well, I've been stopped before, but, like, I have a story that one time I was walking with my friends, and there was, like, five of us, but I went inside my house, and a cop pulled them over and said, there's a, we just got a report that, you know, that there's four youth going around and they're doing something, whatever they were doing or whatever, and, like, they're of color or whatever, and they just stopped us and, you know, stopped them, when really there was really five of us, and, like, they patted them down. And something else that, you know, how we're affected is when citizens, when they walk by us, and they hear in the paper that, you know, we're criminals, and they show us as criminals, then whenever they walk by us, they're going to cross the street or clutch their bags, and that has happened to me. And also, when we go into stores to buy things, you know, like the people who work there will follow us around through the aisles or whatever to make sure we don't steal.
Have you talked to the New York Times about your findings?
We had a meeting with the New York Times, and while they didn't refute any of our numerical findings, they did say that a lot of our facts were based on our own opinions. And
as opposed to their opinions.
Absolutely. And they said that they didn't think much of the study, but we do, however, think that we have a victory because not many people meet with the Times, let alone youth, let alone people who are criticizing the Times. So although it was a very difficult meeting, we see it as a victory.
Who did you meet with?
We met with John Landman, Susan Edgerly, Tony Marcano, and Kevin Flynn. Of the Metro section. We only met with the Metro section of the Times.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean they said that you were just wrong?
Well, I think to Kia, I think that the meeting was an hour and a half long, and I think what they disagree with was not our findings themselves, but our interpretation of the findings. I think their argument was that we're looking at episodic reporting, and we're asking questions like, why aren't current trends being mentioned in episodic reporting? Why does the decline in juvenile crime seemed to be invisible? There was only one article out of 93 that mentioned a decline in juvenile crime. Why do greater context factors like maybe economic hardships or educational lack of resources or gun availability, which was only mentioned sparsely in the 93 articles, all about youth and crime, many of them about crimes involving a gun? And we were asking questions about context and background and bigger picture, and their response was that every once in a while a feature will come along and cover those things, and most of the time reporting will not cover those things. And so, you know, we could call it a difference of opinion, you could call it sort of not agreeing with us. I think actually it's a neglect to take responsibility for the impact that the New York Times coverage must have on policymakers, on citizens, on teachers, on police officers, on all of the people that these young folks interact with all the time.
Why do you think the New York Times should be accountable to you?
Well, the New York Times is one of the most influential newspapers in the world. Most people that read it are people of political power who make laws, policies that affect youth. And we chose the Times because we figured if we can get them to change the way they do their reporting, other newspapers would look up to that, other media outlets would look up to that and change the way they report on youth.
Did you read the New York Times before you were doing this study?
I didn't. I personally did not.
I did every now and then, not too much.
I did, weekly.
You did. Are you reading the Times now?
Yes. Yes, I do now. That's one of the things I got out of the Media Watch. I learned quite a lot.
I see a coding chart that you have in the back of your report, in between the lines, how the New York Times frames youth. Can you talk about this?
Sure.
Pia Infante of We Interrupt This Message.
What this coding chart will show you is actually every single article that we coded. And when we say coded, it means that we looked carefully at every article and we asked questions that were standard questions that we asked of every single article so that we would be able to tabulate, for instance, how many times young people were portrayed as criminals and how many times they were portrayed as victims. We were able to tabulate how many quotes police officers had versus how many quotes young people had. And all of these coding categories eventually led us to the findings that we created. So they're sort of statistical studies.
We basically asked the questions that most reporters didn't ask in order to get our information.
Like what?
Like, does the article mention gun availability?
Is this part of a trend?
Right.
Has crime risen or fallen?
How many direct quotes by youth and police and officials? How many indirect quotes? Things like that.
And we're not saying that, you know, we're experts in journalism, but we're experts in our own experiences, and we experience the results of the media criminalizing youth.
I think the other thing that this coding chart provides is documentation, and I think documentation is what we're out to what we're out to do, because if you ask any young person walking down the street, if you ask some of the young people sitting in the back of the studio right now, does the news media, particularly the New York Times, often seem to misportray youth of color as criminals? And they will all tell you yes, and then none of them will have necessarily done a study. But the point of this study was to document what these folks experience all the time and use it as a tool to be able to affect policy, affect other media outlets, and educate community members and folks across the country about what the impact is of bad coverage, inaccurate coverage, and biased coverage.
You didn't read the New York Times very much before you did the study. Where did you get your information? Did you get it from any news sources, just from your friends? What?
I got it from the news.
TV.
The television news, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I got it from the same place too, basically, and also from being, stopped and patted down, and people crossing the street. I mean, that had me wondering why would that happen, and then observing the news and reading the paper, that it showed me why this is going on.
What about TV news? Is that going to be your next hit? Are you going to be analyzing the TV news? And do you think it reflects the same thing as the New York Times?
Actually, there's a project that's going to be starting in the Bay Area called a Youth Media Council. And that Youth Media Council is also going to be looking at television news and doing a study of television news. And that is actually a project of We Interrupt This Message in San Francisco.
Does this make you want to be a part of the media or not? Your study called In Between the Lines, How the New York Times Frames Youth.
Actually, it would make us, want to get more involved because, it's voicing our sides more because that's what we want to do. We want to voice our sides. And, we want to break all these stereotypes because we're not criminals. I mean, because, their reporting is being that it's mostly on us being criminals, it takes away the good things that we've done. Like us, we're doing this here. We're involved in activism, and as myself, I'm a poet, and I'm a Christian rapper. They won't do no articles on that. And being involved, and being able to be a part of the media, that can we can express ourselves in what we do and stuff like that.
Do you have a rap that you'd like to share with us, Joseph?
I don't have army, but No, not really. I don't have all this.
Do you have any that you memorized?
Sure, I have. But it's my rap that I do is Christian rap.
Okay.
I'll share it.
Okay.
Okay, let me see.
Not to put you on the spot.
What can I think now?
You couldn't possibly be suffering from stage fright, could you?
Never. Yep. Just got to think of a rhyme.
Well, just one sec. Do we have that rap ready?
All right, I can say
it's
right
you,
now.
Joey.
All right, all right. Through dark clouds, I'ma be praising aloud. Through whirlwinds, I'ma stand strong, cause I've been rid of my sins. While most of y'all rubbing your chins, wondering why I have joy. Cause Jesus to me is like Christmas to a boy. I can never try to avoid all the wonderful things my father brings. You can never try to
deny.
Well,
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Joseph Vasquez and Quesha Elakin, both 18, with Youth Force, a South Bronx youth organization in New York, and Pia Infante with the group We Interrupt This Message. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Terry Allen. Our engineer is Anthony Sloan. Our technical director, Errol Maitland. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Thank you, Jeff.